Sermons from the Journey is an audio podcast of the weekly message preached by Reverend Rebecca Clark, pastor at Trinity United Methodist Church in Montpelier, Vermont, and blogging online at pastorbecca.com. Thanks for listening.
What's up? What's new? It's been a little while. I've been a little busy. I've been gone for 2 weeks at the United Methodist Church's General Conference, which is the once a quadrennium meeting of United Methodists from all over the world, where we hash out, I think that's an appropriate way of putting it, hash out our politics, our positions, our theology, and where we worship together and live together in this glorious, messy community of the United Methodist Church. And while I was at General Conference, I learned firsthand, or relearned firsthand, an age-old saying that is, if you want to make God laugh, tell God the plans that you've made. We saw this in a couple of different ways. If you want to make God laugh, show God, tell God your carefully constructed, well-researched, theologically grounded, categorically unquestioned plans, and watch and listen for the divine laughter to roll. So, as you know, our church is a big worldwide denomination. And as a big worldwide denomination, it costs a lot of money to run. And there's a lot of kind of redundancies and double ups and redundancies and stuff. And so there was a need, and I think a true need, to streamline and to restructure some of the overall structure of the denomination so that local churches, like this one, who support the structure with our gifts to ministry, aren't overburdened by the sort of top-down hierarchy of supporting a global denomination, but are free to do the important vital ministry that we do on the ground. It's a good effort and an important one. And so over the course of several years, most particularly over about the past year and a half to 2 years, the United Methodist Church put together a team and studied this problem and paid at least $500,000 in studies about the decline of the Methodist Church and the mainline church in America and what seemed to be wrong and what could be done about it. And put together these studies over the course of a couple of years, and they have all kinds of alphabet soup names. There were really three different plans that kind of came forward, and the details aren't too significant to belabor you with and bore you to tears with between them. But the idea being consolidating the work of the boards and agencies that serve the church to make them more streamlined. And the problem that a lot of folks, including myself, had with these various plans in their various configurations is that this consolidation was not just a streamlining, but was really a consolidation of power. In the hands of very few people, and not necessarily a representative, diverse group of people, but an appointed board of, say, 15 or 30 or 45, it kind of didn't matter how many, an appointed board of a relatively fixed number of people to make decisions, big, huge decisions for the entire church. And there seemed to be something fundamentally un-Methodist about that. We're a very kind of grassroots, democratic sort of people. We like everybody to have a say, and so this sense of consolidation seemed and felt wrong. And at the same time, there was also the elimination of some important kind of checks and balances in the power structure of our church. The prime example is two boards that we have, the General Commission on the Status and Role of Women and the General Commission on Religion and Race. These are two kind of like independent organizations that monitor and, if you will, audit the church to lift up the dangers of or instances they see of racism or sexism. And those were going to be consolidated into a Committee on Inclusiveness, subservient to the body they were trying to monitor. And that seemed wrong in lots of ways. So these plans, these three different plans with their different alphabet letters in front of them, came up through the committee that was supposed to do these things, and the committee talked about, debated, tried to perfect each one of them, and then voted each one down. And so then the people who were involved in two of the plans, because they weren't going to talk to the people from the third plan, got together and they made a fourth plan over the course of just a couple of days, and they brought that fourth plan not through a committee but directly to the floor of General Conference, where 960 some odd delegates were supposed to debate, amend, and perfect a plan for the restructure of the entire church in a morning. And it didn't go terribly well. But it did pass. This plan, it was called Plan UMC by this point, passed, and it passed by, you know, one of those margins in the high 50 range, and many of us were very upset. I was very upset because I thought there was much about this plan that still had the same problems that all those other ones had. It wasn't representational. It was a consolidation of power. It eliminated the voices speaking for justice for women and persons of color, on and on and on. And then we passed a whole bunch of other things I didn't like. And by Friday morning, I was done. Done with General Conference, and pretty sure I was almost done with the United Methodist Church. Before I went, somebody asked me to promise them to come home Methodist, because they knew that that's a liability of going to General Conference, this potential to not want to be Methodist anymore. And I was like, if I come home Christian, that's going to be a good start. But they asked me to try to come home Methodist, and what I was planning to say to that friend was, I'm still Methodist, but I don't think the church is anymore. We were that far removed. I was that upset Friday morning, mostly because of this plan and kind of the power and negativity I felt it represented. So Friday morning, we're voting, and we're voting on the budget now to fund the church for 4 years, and I'm literally voting no on everything just to be contrary, just because it's the only voice I have left, and I'm frustrated, and I'm bitter, and I'm angry. And we're supposed to close all of business by 5 p.m., but there's a window to do some from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. Friday night, and we all knew we were going to be there because we had a lot left to do. We tend to run over, I know, surprise. And at 4:15 on Friday, you see, we'd put forward our one last Hail Mary pass effort to say we really don't think this plan is right. And so we sent it to the Judicial Council, which is like the Methodist Supreme Court. We said, we really don't think this plan is right. And the Supreme Court, the Judicial Council, came back at 4:15 p.m. on Friday and handed down their ruling, which said that Plan UMC was categorically and unsalvageably unconstitutional according to the Constitution of the United Methodist Church, because you can't consolidate that much power in the hands of that few people. And chaos broke out. This is what chaos looks like. Chaos reigned supreme. Now, for a lot of people, good people, faithful, devout people who had put a lot of time and effort into it, this was devastating. This was all their hard work, $500,000 in study, who knows how many meetings and plane tickets and gatherings and lodging and blood and sweat and tears poured into this thing, and folks were devastated. But a good 40% of us went, oh. It was like the Spirit had blown into General Conference a couple of weeks early. It's not Pentecost yet, but here's that wily Spirit working outside the liturgical calendar. I'm not sure that's allowed, but there she was, and it was like we had another chance. And so this picture is actually a whole bunch of people, I'm buried in the middle of that picture somewhere, converging upon literally the communion table, which was in the middle of the room. I think that's great. Going, what do we need to do? What do we need to do? What do we need to put in place to make sure that these boards and agencies and the church can function for 4 years? And then we'll try to come up with a better plan. We got 4 years to make a better, more inclusive, you know, more embracing, more just plan. But we need to leave here with some stuff in place so that people can operate. And so we're trying to figure all of that out. It was holy chaos. But chaos is indeed holy. It's where the Spirit works. The early church had no structure plan. They had no evangelism plan. They had no natural church development plan. They had no mechanism by which to assess their spiritual gifts and their needs for growth. They were just loving Jesus and telling other people about it, and it seemed to work pretty well for them. But they did have categories and assumptions. and boxes that were kind of like plans. And if you want to make God laugh, tell God not only your plans, but your boxes and your categories. A big box in the first century church was the sense that everybody who started in this movement was Jewish. Jesus was Jewish. Jesus' disciples were Jewish. So clearly this was a movement coming through and from within Judaism. And so there were some folks who felt that that meant it should be limited to people who were Jewish. Made pretty good sense at the time. Didn't make sense to everybody, and it certainly didn't seem to make sense to the Holy Spirit, who could not be contained to people who were Jewish. And so in the passage that I read from Acts, Peter is preaching and people are moved and they receive the Spirit upon the whole crowd, everybody who's listening, and a whole bunch of the folks who are coming at this from the Jewish perspective and the Jewish movement look around and they say, wait a minute, what are all these Gentiles doing? Having these ecstatic religious experiences and speaking in tongues. And Peter recognizes, he said, these people have received the same Spirit we have received. Is there anyone who is willing to withhold the water for baptizing them? I love that we use water as an image of God's grace, right? If you've ever tried to withhold water, say flood water, it's a hopeless cause. You can stick your fingers in the dams all you want, but water is going to come through when it's determined to come through. Water as a metaphor for God's grace or God's justice, right? Like an ever-flowing stream. Try to stop that. Just go ahead. I double dog dare you. Is there anyone willing to withhold the water, this very symbol of God's grace, of baptism, that these folks who have received the same Spirit we have received might be baptized? There was another moment of plans and categories and visions and hopes and expectations falling into brokenness. And it's probably the moment that more of you who have been following United Methodist politics for any length of time expect to hear me talk about. It is the controversy of our denomination for the past 40 years, our church's position about sexuality, particularly homosexuality. Now, our church's position is not supportive of homosexuality, and a lot of you, probably most of you, know that I disagree with that position. Many of you will disagree with me on that, and some of you will agree with me on that, and we're not going to take a straw poll. That's okay. And the reason that's okay is that we agree, we covenant to live together in love. We know that we love God, we love Christ. We love one another. And so the fact that we disagree, even disagree powerfully, over something that does strike at some of the more important parts of ourselves is okay because we live together in love. But the denomination, you see, when we all get together and we're in this big room and we're setting policy, we lose sight of that sometimes. And the feeling in the room wasn't necessarily that we all agreed to live together in love. Someone put that wording forward. In fact, a couple people put it forward. Two very prominent, very well-known clergymen in the United Methodist Church, big, huge names, one of them, Mike Slaughter, author, you know, great, great guy. Adam Hamilton, another author. We used his stewardship program a few years ago, Enough, with great success, a phenomenal guy. These are moderate, level-headed guys who put forward this wording that said, very clearly, here's the position of the church. Here's the folks who agree with it and why. Their theological, scriptural positions, why. Here are the folks who disagree with it and why. Their theological, scriptural reasons why. And in this tension, they wrote, we have a choice. We can agree to live together, or we can schism as a church. We can fragment as a church and go our separate ways. And we choose to live together in this tension. We choose to love one another and to love all people. That amendment failed. And another one similar to it failed. By more than 50%, obviously. One by 57%, one by over 60%. It was a broken moment. It was a painful moment. It was anticipated and suspected, but that didn't make it hurt less. And it was shocking, not because really the position of the church didn't change, it remains unchanged, and that kind of, that we knew that, but that this language of let's agree to disagree, let's live in this tension together, didn't have any more success than any other vote we've ever taken on the subject. And that was hard. People were crying on both sides of the bar. I have this little insert picture in there so you can see there's a bar around the edge of the voting area, right? So all the delegates sit in the middle on the floor where we can vote in our assigned seats. And then on three sides of us, there are viewing stands and folks sit there. And if you are not a delegate, if you don't have a voting card, you can't come on to the floor. If you come onto the floor during session and you don't leave, you can be arrested. That's happened before. Not this year, thankfully, but that's happened before. And unfortunately, one of the things that really bugged me all week was that that bar was in place even when we were worshiping, which seemed fundamentally wrong to me. But we would be worshiping, and the people in the middle, the delegates, would all be worshiping together in the center, and then there's these bleachers around the outside. And there are people worshiping outside. But it seemed so fundamentally wrong that there was this bar in place, this literal boundary in place during worship. But there it was. And that bar was in place, that boundary was in place in this moment of brokenness. Broken for the people on the inside of the bar, broken for the people on the outside of the bar, broken for the people on the inside of the church and its establishment, and the people on the outside of the church and its establishment. And as you can see, it was very painful. But at the same time, I felt a kind of peace and calm. I knew what to do. We all know what to do. I knew what was planned, but that's not the point. I know what to do with brokenness. We are a people who know that being broken means being broken open. And we proclaim a particular kind of brokenness, a brokenness that contains in it hope, a brokenness out of which comes healing and salvation. So we did what we do with brokenness. As recess was called, we converged on the table, the communion table. Delegates from the floor went directly to the table, and folks from outside the divide came in. And they brought with them fabric for an altar cloth, and they brought with them a loaf of bread and a cup and little napkins with wafers and little more cups of grape juice. I was the ordained elder closest to where the bread landed on the table. And I know what to do with brokenness. So I picked it up. I said silently the prayer of consecration over the elements. I lifted the bread above my head and broke it as the body was broken. I looked across the table into the eyes of a friend and brother who had worked with me in committee for a week and who was holding aloft the cup. And we sang and we prayed and we passed the bread to one another. And the cups of juice and the napkins full of wafers went out from the communion table around the floor and were offered to people who voted one way or another. And the cups and the napkins of wafers went out to the edges to the folks still on the outside of the bar and offered the body of Christ to them. In brokenness, we know what to do. I wasn't thinking of this passage that I read from Acts this morning. I've never preached on it before. I don't know if I've ever really noticed it before. But I was thinking of this moment when I read the passage later this week. Who is willing to withhold water from them, from the uncircumcised, from the Gentiles, from those outside the group, when God's Spirit has clearly fallen upon them? Can anyone stand in the way of that? Is anyone willing to stand in the way of that? In that moment when the barriers come down, did not the Holy Spirit move the whole church to a new place, to a new day, to a new understanding of who we are in brokenness, in tension, in division? The work of the Spirit is messy and moving in brokenness. Broken plans, broken categories, broken hearts, broken bread. It's not always pretty. In fact, we call it the ugly cry for a reason. Here's my ugly cry face. Oh, there it is. It is not always pretty, maybe rarely pretty. But in our brokenness and our messiness, I believe the Spirit moves us to a new day. In the brokenness of our well-constructed plans falling apart, we have an opportunity to build something new. In the brokenness of our division laid plain, we have an opportunity to say, even if the general church won't say it, that we live in love with one another, no matter our disagreement. It was a different sacrament, but the question was the same. And so is the answer, and so is the reason for it. The reason is that the Spirit is moving, changing us in brokenness beyond plans and categories. The question, the same. Who is willing to withhold the symbols of grace, of God's presence lived and witnessed through the church in the world? Who is willing to withhold these things from those outside, those queer people, those folks beyond the curtain, beyond the bar, those folks outside the doors of the church? Who is willing to withhold the plate and the cup, the body and blood of Christ, the bread of new life, the cup of salvation? We can only ever answer that question for ourselves. I can only answer that question for myself. Who is willing to withhold the symbols of grace from God's people who have clearly received the same Spirit? Not me. Never me. Our closing hymn is one of my Holy Trinity of favorites. It speaks to God working through the new and mysterious, even in the midst of threats of dire predictions, to resurrect the church. It has five glorious verses. In the midst of new dimensions, number 2238.